WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cuba is still a communist country, in spite of the fact that the country which was its greatest ally and greatest source of consumer goods no longer exists. Without the Soviet Union, Cuba is in big trouble, facing terrible shortages and economic disaster. The American trade embargo is still in effect, and there's even a movement to tighten restrictions. It's not easy for American journalists to get prolonged access to Cuba, but my guest Andres Oppenheimer managed to spend 5 months there over the past year and a half. He also made several trips to Cuba in the 80s. Oppenheimer is the author of the new book Castro's Final Hour, about life in Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Oppenheimer is a senior foreign correspondent at the Miami Herald. He's covered Latin America for 15 years. Oppenheimer says his time in Cuba showed him that it's over for Castro.
5 years ago, when I went to Cuba and I stopped people on the street, it was very hard, almost impossible, to get a criticism of the Cuban Revolution or of Fidel Castro. Everybody will tell you, this country is great, we are very advanced in health and education and this and that. 3 years ago, when the things started collapsing in the Soviet bloc, a lot of people would tell you, well, we have some problems, this is not an easy time, but the revolution has accomplished many things, has brought about many social changes for the better. A year ago, many people would say, things are really bad. And today, people are not only criticizing the Cuban Revolution as it is today, but are also starting to point at Fidel Castro himself.
I think a lot of the discontent in Cuba has to do with the shortages that Cuba has been experiencing since the collapse of the Soviet Union. What has Castro's plan been for making up for the things that the Soviet Union is no longer supplying Cuba?
Castro has come up with something he has called special period in times of peace, which is the equivalent of a war economy. He has started importing bicycles to replace cars, oxen to replace tractors, etc., etc. Since 1989, Cuba has become a different country. You wouldn't recognize it today. On the streets, you see people, I tell in my book anecdotes about me, for instance, one day driving on a narrow street in Old Havana, and almost bumping into a 60-year-old grandmother who was riding her bike for the first time because she could not go to work in the bus anymore because they were cutting back on bus routes because of lack of shortages of gasoline. So this woman was forced to start riding a bike at age 60, and this is one of the many things that you see happening in Cuba every day. They're going back to, the way they would put it, to the Stone Ages.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's electricity outages for about 8 hours each day, I think.
Right now, there are electricity outages like 8 hours a day. But it's not just the shortages of food and almost everything else. And by the way, one of the interesting things I found in Cuba talking about shortages is that a lot of people are more irked by the shortage of soap and deodorant than, believe it or not, of food.
Because, yeah, why is that?
Well, I have a wonderful interview with a friend of mine who told me, you know, this may be difficult to understand for you living in the West, living in the United States, but I personally resent more the shortage of soap than of food because you can trick your stomach by drinking coffee, he told me. I drink coffee several times a day, he said, but try not shaving for 2 or 3 days. Try not washing your hand with soap for 2 or 3 days, and your self-esteem goes down, and you feel terrible, and it turns you into a different person. That's something that really gets on our nerves, he said. And he said, you know, you foreign journalists, you keep talking about the food shortages, but you miss, like, these little details of daily life which put a lot of strain on the Cuban population.
In 1990, Castro ordered the mobilization of 200,000 Havana residents to farms. Is that program still in effect, and what were the reasons behind it?
Well, the reasons was that Cuba depended on the Soviet Union for much of its food imports, and suddenly, when these food imports started flowing into Cuba, he needed to provide food for his people, so he started this mass forced mobilization from Cubans from the city to the countryside. I went to the countryside to see this this process, and regardless of all the official statements that it's doing great, it's a big camp. That's what it is. People go there, are forced to go.
You mean like summer camp or detention camp?
No, summer camp. Nobody takes it very seriously. They're forced to go. They don't want to go. And imagine, they don't work that much. Imagine if they put you on me, people accustomed to city life, to grow potatoes. We don't know how to do it. So people who are into the agribusiness sector in Cuba, a lot of them are very skeptical because they say this is a big charade. We're not going to feed our population by taking accountants and a philosophy professor from Havana and have them, you know, growing potatoes.
You point out that over 55% of the Cuban population was born after the revolution, and the group of the population most disenfranchised from the revolution is the youth.
That's incredible, because it was exactly the opposite to what I expected to find. I was interviewing once in order to find out what the Cuban youth thought. I wanted not only to talk with the young people hanging out at the Malecón at the Seaside Avenue and Boulevard in Havana, but I decided to do something different. So I said, you know, how about looking for Che Guevara's grandchildren and look at what has become of them? It was very funny because I was interviewing one of Che Guevara's daughters, and suddenly I see this kid walking into the room with long hair, earrings, this 17-year-old kid. And I started talking to him, and suddenly it dawned on me that he was a much more interesting interview than his daughter, because he was a heavy metal rock musician who sang his songs in English and was very angry at Fidel Castro and at his revolution for being what he called an institution and a repressive one. And he told me, this revolution is in ruins. And he gave me a lot of examples about why a young kid like him is against the current course of the Cuban Revolution.
What's one of the examples he gave you?
Well, for instance, he said, look at me. I wore long hair and earrings. When I go to the street, the police will grab me and take me to the police station and cut my hair. Imagine the irony, he said. When Raul Castro came down from the mountain during the revolution, he was wearing a ponytail just like me. And now he and his people in power are taking kids like me and cutting our hair forcefully. So he said, the revolution has turned into an institution. So for these kids, this revolution is a revolution of grandparents, a revolution of people in Fidel's generation, who, by the way, occupy most positions of power, who are not allowing the younger generation to move up and to do their thing.
Castro is trying to build the economic future of Cuba on the tourist industry. And you say he's created virtually an apartheid system because Cubans are more or less banned from the tourist hotels and the tourist restaurants. What's the point of that?
Well, that's the most incredible irony of the Cuban Revolution. And that's why I say when I talk in that chapter about tourism, that the Cuban Revolution has gone full circle. In 1959, one of the big things of the Cuban Revolution that created so much illusions, not only in Cuba but in Latin America, was the fact of finishing with prostitution, with apartheid system that prevented blacks and mulattoes and Cubans from joining in the pleasures and the casinos that the tourists were enjoying, that the revolution had ended that. And now, 33 years later, we have in Havana a new apartheid system where the Cubans cannot go into the hotels where we foreigners are staying, where the Cuban people cannot go into a store to buy soap or to buy, you know, goods that are available only to Westerners, only to Western visitors, and where Cubans cannot even mingle with the foreigners in specially designated places like hotels that are only for foreigners.
Mm-hmm. So what is the point of keeping Cubans out of the tourist hotels and restaurants?
Well, to begin with, the Cuban government wants to prevent the political contamination of people. Contact with Westerners promotes ideas that the Cuban Communist Party is not very happy with. And that's precisely why this policy won't work, because Fidel Castro is creating very limited islands of efficiency within the Cuban system, tourism being one of them. But he refuses to expand them for fear that his people will become contaminated by democratic thoughts. That's why he's refusing to expand these islands of efficiency, and that's why the system won't work, because if you take the profits out of tourism and throw them into an inefficient economy, you're throwing money into a bottomless barrel. So tourism will not save the Cuban economy.
In the meantime, the jobs in the tourist industry have become the prestige jobs.
Right. Every Cuban I have met in the several months I spent in Havana, I met a lot of people, doctors, professors. A lot of young people want to get into tourism because that's the only way they have access to foreigners, and getting access to foreigners is the only way to get soap, shampoo, all the things that are available only to foreigners, and many of them, their only chance to meet a foreigner who perhaps would fall in love with them and take them out of the country.
Mm. So the tourist hotels and restaurants are protected from the shortages?
For foreigners.
For foreigners, right.
The hotels and tourism shops are only for foreigners and are pretty well stocked. But only foreigners can go. And a lot of Cubans approach you on the street asking that you please go to the diplotiendas, which is what they're called, and buy something for them, which they can't get. For instance, soap. And the other thing, now more than ever, because what used to happen all these years was that the thousands of Soviets in Havana especially and in Cienfuegos, they were big black marketeers. A lot of spouses of Soviet technicians went to the Diplo stores, to these foreigners-only stores, and bought big quantities of soap or shampoo or this or that, and then sold them to their Cuban neighbors in their neighborhoods. But now that the Soviet technicians are gone, there's a shortage of people to get these items.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andres Oppenheimer, senior correspondent for the Miami Herald and author of the new book, Castro's Final Hour. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Andres Oppenheimer is my guest, author of the new book, Castro's Final Hour. One of the things that's happening now is a lot of the Cuban exiles who have been living in Miami are planning for their return to Cuba. You write that one thing that both Castro and his opponents agree on is that the Miami exiles are politically out of touch. How?
Well, let's qualify that. There are several sectors within the Miami Cuban exile community. The most extreme right-wing sectors of that community play right into Castro's hands because they want pretty much a civil war in Cuba. They want an armed struggle to bring down Fidel Castro. And a lot of them are talking about recovering their properties. So a lot of people I talk to in Cuba who don't like Fidel Castro and who want to get rid of him fear for their lives because they say, you know, we want a peaceful transition to democracy. We don't want a civil war. And others say, look, I've been living in this house for 30 years. I don't want somebody who is living a good life in Miami all this time when I was sacrificing myself and living really poorly to come any day, knock on my door, and get me out of this house. But I have to say that the majority of the Cuban exiles have matured a lot in recent years, and they know and understand that they can't go into Cuba and sort of recover what once was theirs, that the country has changed, and that they have to play a constructive role.
You think there'd be a big racial division if a lot of exiles returned because it was white and lighter-skinned Cubans who were the ones to leave prominently?
Cuba has changed substantially over the past 30 years. Almost all of the Cubans who left Cuba, especially in the early years after the revolution, were white. More than 95% of the Cuban exiles in Miami are white. If you live in Miami the way I do and you go to Calle Ocho, which is where the center of Little Havana, you see a completely different crowd than if you go to Cuba and you stand on 23rd Street and Malecón, which is sort of an equivalent place in Havana. Cuba has become a darker, racially more black, more mulatto place than it used to be. And many of these blacks and mulattoes in Cuba have benefited from the revolution in the sense that they are now living in the homes left behind by the white Cubans who fled to Miami and New Jersey. And I would not say that they support the revolution because, look, the general discontent is growing so fast that I would say that without any doubt that Fidel Castro is at the rock bottom of his popular support ever. But these people have something to lose, and they want assurances that if the situation changes, they won't be kicked out of their places.
Mm-hmm. Both President Bush and presidential hopeful Bill Clinton want to tighten trade restrictions on Cuba. What effect do you think that would have?
I think that's political posturing because, you know, right now the United States doesn't have a real Cuba policy. It has a short-term Miami policy, if you want to call it that way. Our whole policy on Cuba is based on domestic political considerations. I think that the kind of measures of tightening the trade embargo they are talking about now, I don't think they will be implemented after the election. And I think it would be counterproductive. I have sort of a middle-of-the-road position on this. I don't think the U.S. should lift the embargo right away because, you know, that will be rewarding a repressive system. On the other hand, I think that tightening the embargo would be giving Fidel Castro a new excuse to go to Latin America and to Spain and claim to be the poor David fighting this aggressive Goliath and win a little bit of sympathy at a time when everybody's turning his back on him.
How do you think Castro keeps managing to hang on?
Well, the obvious answer is the only thing that still works in Cuba to some degree is a repressive system, a police state. But also, although he is having less popular support than ever, there are some sectors in Cuba who are afraid of the future. And the political system, the Communist Party, does what it can to fuel these fears. For instance, you open up Granma, the official paper, every day, and there are stories about unemployed in Poland, about people in East Germany, in what used to be East Germany, fired from their jobs, etc., etc. So I tell, you know, I found very funny anecdotes of people who have make-work jobs that sound, you know, ridiculous to somebody coming from the West. And these people know that in a market economy, they will lose their jobs right away because their jobs don't make any economic sense. So these people, and I, if I remember correctly, of the 3.5 million people listed by the Cuban Census Bureau in the Cuban workforce, 1.1 million hold what the Cuban Census Office calls non-productive jobs. A lot of these people would be out of the job in a matter of hours if a market economy replaced the current system. So these people, even though they don't agree with Fidel and many of them would like the system to change, they fear for the future.
Why do you think Castro never opened up his thinking to perestroika-style reforms?
I think he lacks the political courage to do it because, look, one of the interesting things I found in Cuba was that we here in the States, when we talk about Cuba, we keep comparing Cuba with Eastern Europe. And when I was talking with Cuban officials, members of the Politburo, the one thing that struck me was that they were not bringing up the case of Eastern Europe. The one thing that was always in their minds was Nicaragua. And they kept saying, we will not make the mistake that the Sandinistas did in Nicaragua. We are not going to call for elections or open up the system in the midst of our worst economic crisis ever, because that's a recipe for losing, and we won't do that.
What do you think is going to happen when Castro is no longer in power, and you think that's pretty inevitable?
Hopefully, and a lot of people of the most conservative Cuban exiles don't agree with this. Hopefully, there will be a peaceful transition where many of the Cuban Communist Party officials who now are in government positions will remain in some capacity in Cuba, and there will be a bloodless, peaceful transition, pretty much like in Russia, because otherwise there's going to be an incredible civil war in Cuba. There's so much accumulated resentment. In every block, you'll find people who tell you, you see, that person across the street, he is responsible for me having spent 10 years in an agricultural camp because he, you know, had something bad to say about me to the Communist Party political commissar. And there's a lot of fear that the minute Fidel falls, everybody's going to take to the streets and kill his neighbor. There's a lot of accumulated resentment.
Can I ask what country you're from?
Argentina. I was a journalist in Argentina, and I left in 1976 when a right-wing military regime took over in Argentina, and I went to study to New York, to Columbia University, because I didn't agree with that regime.
Do you think that being Latin American and having left a military regime helped you get access to people you wanted to talk to in Cuba?
I think so. And also, I had an open mind regarding the Cuban Revolution, like virtually every other person growing up in Latin America. When I studied there, I used to see the Cuban Revolution from the distance with a measure of respect and sympathy. These people looked like idealist revolutionaries who were wanting to bring some social benefits to their people. So from the distance, that looked pretty good. And perhaps, I don't know, because I didn't go to Cuba at that time, perhaps that was the case in the 60s and 70s. But when I look at Cuba today, I did not see that much difference between a leftist police state and a rightist police state. When a country puts somebody in prison for 15 years, like the Cuban government did just 3 weeks ago, a person, and I'm talking about just the latest political prisoner, Indamiro Restano, not for taking arms against the regime, because I think every government is entitled to take measures against people who take arms against the government, but just for saying he wants a multi-party system in Cuba, when a system puts somebody in prison just for talking, then I think there's no much difference between a right-wing and a left-wing military regime. They're the same. They're military regimes.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate your inviting me.
Andres Oppenheimer is a senior foreign correspondent at the Miami Herald. His new book is Castro's Final Hour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.